Thanks very much. I will do my best to keep you awake, rather. I don't usually begin my lectures by quoting from the Daily Mail or the Mail on Sunday, but this headline did make me buy the copy when I saw it in the shop. World exclusive, the Gospel of Judas Iscariot, greatest archaeological discovery of all time, threat to 2,000 years of Christian teaching. That was nearly 5 years ago now. Now, this idea of the lost gospel being... or got into the New Testament in the end. I remember when Pete and I went to see the film of the Da Vinci Code when it first came out, that Pete told me that his favourite scene was the scene of the Council of Nicaea, where the bishops are literally sort of screaming and shouting at each other, arguing about which Gospels should go into the canon. But of course, since no scholar thinks that the canon was even discussed at the Council of Nicaea, it's hard to know what to make of that one. But nevertheless... what are the differences between the New Testament Gospels that we have and these others? What is it that makes the four New Testament Gospels so special that's not true of those apocryphal Gospels, as they're sometimes called? Is there any reason why these are so special? Or is it merely a result of a political decision made from on high, even if it wasn't decided by the Emperor Constantine at the Council of Nicaea? Now, what I propose to do in this talk is, first of all, to give you a snapshot of how Jesus is presented in the four New Testament Gospels, and then we're going to take three case studies of different non-canonical, apocryphal Gospels to see how they match up. So, first of all, some of the central features of the New Testament Gospels. We know roughly when the four New Testament Gospels were written, and almost every scholar agrees that they were probably written between about AD 60 and about AD 90. If there's one thing that they agree on, it's that Mark was written first and that John was written last. And in fact, there's even a very early church tradition going back all the way to the second century that John was the last of the Gospel writers to write towards the end of his life, towards the end of the first century. The last of the New Testament Gospels, then, was written about 60 years after the death of Jesus and resurrection of Jesus. The first Easter in sort of AD 30 or AD 33, roughly 60 years before the composition of that last Gospel. And this is going to be important later on when we come back to look at the question of the eyewitnesses. But for now, the basic point is that they were roughly written between this period of AD 60 and AD 90. So what are these Gospels about? Well, of course, they're about Jesus. And the first point that the Gospel writers really draw attention to is how Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. And we can see this all the way through. We come across it after the first verse of Mark's Gospel. After the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, we then have immediately how Jesus fulfills a prophecy. So it's written in Isaiah the prophet, "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. A voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for him." So we see, first of all, how the Old Testament points forward to John the Baptist. But, of course, the main point here is that the Old Testament is stating that John the Baptist has come to prepare for someone even greater, the Lord himself, Jesus Christ. Now, Matthew's Gospel is even more intense in its concentration on Jesus as being the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And already in the first two chapters, we have, first of all, a genealogy showing how all the Old Testament is pointing forward to Jesus. Jesus is the culmination of that. And then we have five references to Old Testament prophecies, just in this first two chapters still of Matthew's Gospel, five statements about how Jesus fulfills Old Testament prophecy. And if you've read the Gospels, you'll be familiar with these. Jesus being the Emmanuel, God with us, forecast in Isaiah, or Jesus being the shepherd from Bethlehem, according to the prophet Micah. And Matthew, throughout his gospel, gives a kind of running commentary on how Jesus' ministry fulfills the Old Testament, with his constant comments about this took place in order to fulfill what was written by the prophet so-and-so. So for Matthew, this especially comes at the beginning, even though it's mentioned throughout as well. Now, Luke does things rather differently. Rather than having a sort of intense concentration on this at the beginning, like Matthew does, Luke really has this at the culmination of the gospel, has this intense focus. So he shows us how the whole of Jesus' ministry, once it's accomplished, has fulfilled the scriptures. It's been all according to plan. So, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. He said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you." This is Jesus talking now. "Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." So Luke is and Jesus are concentrating on saying that this is no historical accident, what has happened all the way through this Gospel of Luke. And it's not just a few old chestnuts that have been fulfilled. It's not just a few sort of classic prophecies like the virgin will bring forth a child. Not just those direct prophecies. No, notice what Luke said in the first quotation, beginning with Moses and all the prophets. And then Jesus goes on to say that everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and in the Psalms. All of this stuff points to him. So, in different ways, all the different kinds of material in the Old Testament, whether it's the commandments highlighting people's sins that Jesus has come to redeem us from, or whether it's the sacrifices in the Old Testament that prefigure Jesus' death on the cross, or whether it's figures like David who prefigure Jesus as the king who undergoes suffering before being crowned. All of this different kind of material in the Old Testament looks forward to Jesus and speaks of him. Now, what is it then that the Old Testament says most about Jesus? Well, look at what this passage goes on to say in Luke's gospel. He told them, "This is what is written, the Christ will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and repentance and forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem." So this leads us from our first point about Jesus as the fulfillment of prophecy in the Gospels, to the second point of what it is that Jesus, how indeed Jesus fulfills this. So Luke focuses here on the fact that Jesus died and rose again. It's Jesus' death and resurrection that leads to the possibility of forgiveness of sins for all who repent. He suffered and rose from the dead on the third day, and repentance and forgiveness of sins will therefore be preached. So the second point, the second main focus of the Gospels is Jesus' death and resurrection, and especially on how this death and resurrection bring us salvation. And we can see this again in the other Gospels as well. So Mark's Gospel, when summing up Jesus' mission, says that the Son of Man came not to serve, sorry, spot the deliberate mistake, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The expectation which many Jews had was that the Messiah would come triumphantly straight away to throw off the oppressive slavery, the oppressive yoke of the Romans, and that this would be the fulfillment of prophecy. It would all take place rather quickly. Jesus, of course, doesn't do that. Before the Son of Man, before Jesus sets up his everlasting kingdom, he first of all gives his life, and this was a bit of a shock. But the problem was, the reason for this surprising move on Jesus' part was because the people of God had got themselves into the situation of being in a debt that they could not repay. For about the first half of the 860 pages of Charles Dickens' novel Little Dorrit, the sort of main character in some ways, Mr. William Dorrit, sits languishing in the Marshalsea debtor's prison, having incurred a debt that he couldn't repay. Then the hero of the novel, Arthur Clennam, makes an amazing discovery that Mr. Dorrit is actually the heir to a great fortune. So excitedly he goes and visits Mr. Dorrit in the debtor's prison and asks Mr. Dorrit what he would most like, what would he most dream of? And Mr. Dorrit points to the wall indicating that he wanted to be outside this wall and free. And so Arthur Clennam says to Mr. Dorrit, "The wall is gone. It is down." So Mr. Dorrit then, of course, leaves the prison a free man, not only out of debt, but actually rich. And similarly, the central message of the New Testament Gospels is that although we had incurred a debt we could not repay, Jesus has come to cancel that debt and to pay it. The Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom, as a redemption for many. God, in his compassion, has sent his Son to ransom us, to get us out of this debtor's prison that we inhabit. John's Gospel is often thought of as telling this story in a slightly different way. If you've read all the Gospels, then you'll notice that John is slightly different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke in its sort of outlook. And it's interesting that in John's Gospel, the clearest statement about the purpose of Jesus' death actually comes from one of Jesus' enemies, the high priest Caiaphas. And he spells out in this way how Jesus dies as the substitute to save others. "Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up, 'You know nothing at all. You do not realize,'" talking to the other priests, "'you do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish.' He did not say this on his own, but as the high priest for that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together, to make them one." So Jesus dies as the substitute for his people, bearing their sin. And when I was preaching on this recently, I tried to make the point that substitution is not a particularly difficult thing to understand. In fact, it's so simple, even a football supporter can understand what a substitute is. So the heart of the gospel, not just in the gospels, as we've seen, but also in Paul's letters and elsewhere in the New Testament, is that Jesus has died and rose from the dead to save God's people. So, two key facts about the Gospels then: Jesus' fulfillment of the Old Testament, and the fact that in his fulfillment, he died to save people from their sins. So how do the other Gospels, how do Thomas and Philip and Judas and the other ones that we've had mentioned a little bit so far already, compare with these? Well, we're going to look at three samples of these in a bit more detail, because I don't think we need to be sort of scared of looking at these things. I don't think they're any threat at all to sort of confusing us or perturbing us. And I think, and sometimes people say to me that having read these things, that if only people sort of knew more about more of what they were about, then they would realize that there wasn't as much of a difficulty after all. They'd realize there was nothing to worry about. Because, of course, the media hype depends partly on the fact that people neither know much of the contents of the New Testament Gospels and know even less of the contents of these extra-canonical, these apocryphal Gospels. So the first case of these others that we're going to look at is the Gospel of Thomas. Now, the Gospel of Thomas is probably one of the earliest of these non-canonical, these Gospels outside of the New Testament. It wasn't really written by the Apostle Thomas. No scholar thinks that. But it was written by someone who wanted to maintain some kind of allegiance to Jesus, and yet with quite an unorthodox approach. Unlike the four New Testament Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas is not a story. It's rather a list or a sort of database of sayings of Jesus, a bit like if you had a red letter Bible and you got rid of all the non-red stuff, what you'd be left with a sort of series of sayings of Jesus. And in these 114 sayings that we have of Jesus, what Jesus really discloses is the saving revelation, the mysterious revelation that one needs to understand in order to be saved. So this is how the gospel begins. "These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke, and which Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote down. And he said, 'Whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not experience death.'" So it's not through the death of Jesus on the cross or through his resurrection that people are saved. It's rather through finding the interpretation of these deep mysteries that Jesus is revealing. That's how you escape the death that's being talked about here. Having said that, despite its differences, there's a surprising amount that the Gospel of Thomas has borrowed from the New Testament Gospels, especially Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There's not really much from John. So if you're reading the Gospel of Thomas, as I'm sure you all do before bed every night, then you'll have noticed that there are some major sort of points of overlap between the Gospel of Thomas and the New Testament. So you'll see that there's a little parallel here between Thomas and one of Jesus' well-known parables, but you can also see that there are some differences. And Jesus said, "The man is like a wise fisherman who cast his net into the sea and drew it up from the sea full of small fish. Among them, the wise fisherman found a fine large fish. He threw all the small fish back into the sea and chose the large fish without difficulty. Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear." Or there's also the parable of the sower, which also has similarities with the parable of the sower in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but with a few differences. So you can see at the end, we don't have 30, 60, or even 100-fold way in which this seed bears fruit, but we have 60 and then 120. But the way in which the Gospel of Thomas differs from the New Testament is even more striking than the similarities that it has. And one of the main points of the Gospel of Thomas is that unlike the New Testament, but rather like some Greek philosophers, the point is emphasized that people's individual souls have already existed since the beginning of time. So you can see that in this saying. Jesus says, "Blessed is he who came into being before he came into being." So the soul of the person pre-exists. The soul of the person exists before the person themselves was born. And this soul comes from paradise, and if the soul correctly understands the deep meaning of Jesus' revelation, then it will go back, it will head back to that paradise, to that kingdom at the end. But in the meantime, the soul is trapped in this physical body, in this material world, and the world is even likened to a corpse, as we can see here. Jesus said, "Whoever has come to understand the world has found only a corpse, and whoever's found a corpse is superior to the world." So the material world is basically a sort of rotten and festering corpse, and that material world, of course, includes our individual physical body. So the goal of religion is for the soul to escape the imprisonment in this physical body and find its way back to the kingdom. "Blessed are the solitary and elect, for you will find the kingdom, for you are from it, and to it you will return." Now, all this comes in the Gospel of Thomas with a fair bit of criticism of rival groups, a fair bit of criticism both of Jews, who are contemporaneous with the author, but also of what one might call the establishment church, not established, but the establishment church, the larger body of the church. So one of the points of criticism that the author makes of both Jews and other Christians is that Jews and other Christians take the Old Testament far too seriously, and the Old Testament should actually be regarded as just coming from dead prophets. So Jesus' disciples said to him, 24 prophets spoke in Israel, and all of them spoke in you. But Jesus said to them, you have omitted the one living in your presence, and have spoken only of the dead. They're getting far too worked up about this Old Testament. Finally, the Gospel of Thomas ends on a bit of a wild card. The very last saying in the Gospel. Simon Peter said to Jesus, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus corrects this view. Jesus said, I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, I don't know whether you prefer Simon Peter's view here or Jesus' view, but either women are excluded from the kingdom altogether, or they can get in as long as they do the honourable thing. That's the Gospel of Thomas, one of the first of the new Gospels to have been written in the second century, and it's very much a sort of protest document against official Orthodox doctrine, and it offers a new vision of Christianity based on understanding mysterious revelation, and based on understanding that mysterious revelation, you can find your way out of the body back to the kingdom of light. So much for the Gospel of Thomas. Like the Gospel of Thomas, to some extent, the Gospel of Judas is also a protest gospel. It's bitterly hostile, even more hostile than the Gospel of Thomas is, to mainstream Christianity. And it devotes as much space in its pages to criticizing everyone else as it does to setting forth what it thinks the good news really is. So here's a sample of that from the beginning of the Gospel of Judas. One day in Judea, he, that's Jesus, came to the disciples and he found them sitting, gathered, practicing their piety. When he met his disciples sitting, gathered, and giving thanks over the bread, he laughed. So immediately we're hit with a rather sort of strange and different picture of Jesus by comparison with what we're used to. Here we've got a laughing Jesus who mocks the traditional piety of the church. And of course, one of the main contrasts that you'll have noticed if you saw any of the sort of media hype about this about 5 years ago is that the figure of Judas in the Gospel of Judas is transformed from, as he is in the Gospel, in the four New Testament Gospels, transformed from being a sort of treacherous plotter to being the recipient of Jesus' revelation, being the trusted disciple, the one who really understands Jesus and the one who receives the truth. And you can see that in this passage, which comes shortly after the first one. Judas said to, we've got sort of bits in brackets, because as Dirk mentioned earlier, the Gospel of Judas is a bit sort of scrappy in its manuscript fragments. Jesus said to him, that's to Jesus, I know who you are and from where you have come. You have come from the immortal Aeon of Barbalo, and the one who sent you is the one whose name I am not worthy to speak. So Judas alone knows who Jesus really is. This new Jesus, this Jesus has come from the Aeon of Barbalo, as Pete mentioned earlier, from outer space. But this is actually a common idea in the second century, representing one of the sort of one of the higher echelons in the heavenly bureaucracy, in the Gnostic scheme of things. So because Judas knows this, knows the truth about Jesus here, Jesus then gives him further instruction. Jesus, knowing that Judas was pondering these exalted things, said to him, separate yourself from them, and I will speak to you the mysteries of the kingdom. So what is it then that Jesus goes on to tell Judas? What are the secrets of the kingdom which he goes on to tell him? Well, it's not a narrative about how Jesus saves through his death and resurrection. Rather, what Judas needs to come to grips with is this whole setup of the heavenly hierarchies and where Barbalo fits in and what comes above Barbalo, the great invisible spirit who's the supreme deity of all, but also how below Barbalo there's another deity who's the creator. In the Gospel of Judas, the world comes into being not having been created by the highest God, but by having been created by an evil god called Saklas, whose name means blind, whose name means stupid in Aramaic. And so because he's an evil god, he's created a very substandard copy of what the world should really be like. So then, this is the creation story. Then Saklas said to his angels, let us make man according to the likeness, according to the image. And they created Adam and his wife Eve, who in the cloud is called Zoe. So this creation doesn't take place by a good God, but actually by an evil God whose name means stupid. And then Jesus then doesn't save the world by coming in to it and dying. In fact, he never even really became part of the world at all. The real Jesus, according to the Gospel of Judas, is really a disembodied spirit. Near the end of Judas's gospel, Jesus says to him as follows, truly I say to you, Judas, you will become greater than them all, for you will sacrifice the man who carries me about. So it's almost as if sort of Jesus is sort of carried along on a trolley, which is his human body. It's not the real him, that human body. So there's no sense of Jesus laying down his life for his friends here, as we read in the four New Testament Gospels. And in fact, one of the things that hit me as I wrote my own book on this strange gospel is that there's not a single reference to love in the Gospel of Judas. There's no love of God, there's no love of Christ in dying for others, there's no love set out as the ideal for the disciples to do, imitating Jesus. It's really a very bitter work, having very little positive to say and much more in the way of criticism of others. The church and the world are doomed, and that really is an essential part of this gospel, as well as the picture of the heavenly hierarchies. Now, our last case is the Gospel of Philip, which we've also had mentioned already. And this is probably one of the most well-known of all the apocryphal Gospels. Even if you hadn't heard of the title before today, you may well be aware of what some people have said about this text. And this is because it's often used in those sort of conspiracy theory views of Jesus' life, according to which he had some kind of relationship and being married, perhaps, to Mary Magdalene. And a lot of people, of course, have come across this in Dan Brown's account, where we read that the companion of the Saviour is Mary Magdalene. Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. This is supposed to be a quotation from the Gospel of Philip. So the character Salih Teabing refers to the Aramaic of the Gospel of Philip and its deep meaning, according to which Jesus is married to Mary Magdalene. Now, this Mary Magdalene and Jesus theory is actually one which gets recycled quite regularly. It's not just Dan Brown. So in 1960, for example, Nikos Kazantzakis wrote a book called The Last Temptation of Christ, a novel in which Jesus is pictured as imagining being married to Mary Magdalene, and this was later made into a controversial film. Then in the 1980s, Michael Bagent and Richard Lee wrote a similar book, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, although this purported to be a historical account of how Jesus and Mary Magdalene got married and had children, and the children then went off and lived quite wisely as in the south of France. So, and then we, of course, have Dan Brown. So I'm sure in about 20 years' time, when everyone has completely forgotten about the Da Vinci Code, there'll probably be another resurrection of this theme again. The Gospel of Philip is generally thought to have been written by a sect called the Valentinians, named after their founder, Valentinus. And this Gospel, the Gospel of Philip, is focused on how the soul must regain its fellowship with Jesus again. And this fellowship, as in some ways with the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Thomas, this fellowship with Jesus has been broken up by the soul being trapped in the physical body. And in the religious worldview of this book, the way in which the soul gets out of the body, escapes, is through a second mystical baptism called the anointing or the chrism. And this seems to have taken place by some sort of ritual event in which the person was anointed with olive oil and received this special baptism. So that, according to the Gospel of Philip, is how you reach a state of perfection. So as I say, it's opposed, like some of the other texts, to the material world and, of course, therefore to the physical body. The spiritual soul inside is the only thing of any value. And as in the case of the Gospel of Judas, the world has not been created by the supreme God, but has been created by a rather sort of dodgy second division deity who didn't really know what he was doing. So, as the Gospel of Philip puts it, the world came about through a mistake. For he who created it, wanted to create him imperishable and immortal, he fell short of attaining his desire. And this low opinion of the material world extends to the physical body as well. No one will hide a large, valuable object in something large, but many a time one has tossed countless thousands into a thing worth a penny. Compare the soul. It is a precious thing, and it came to be in a contemptible body. So you toss countless thousands into a thing worth a penny. You might have a jewellery box that's worth far less than the things that are inside it. And similarly, the soul is a precious thing, but it's contained in this contemptible body, according to the Gospel of Philip. But as I say, it can be rescued if you go through this process of the double baptism, the second spiritual baptism, which is called the chrism. For this reason, it is fitting to baptize in both, in the light, the superior baptism, as well as in the water, the sort of conventional baptism. Now, the light is the chrism. You need to have both, but the mystical anointing of light, the chrism, is superior. So, the chrism is superior to baptism, for it's from the word chrism that that we have been called Christians. Certainly not because of the word baptism. I mean, people don't go around calling themselves Baptists, do they, after all? As I say, the Gospel of Philip has been one of the main inspirations for books like The Holy Blood and The Holy Grail, or The Da Vinci Code. And there is some surprising stuff in the Gospel of Philip about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They probably did, according to this gospel, have some kind of special spiritual relationship. But one needs to be a bit careful when one's going to the details on this in the Gospel of Philip. And this is because over the last sort of millennium and a half or so, the manuscript of the Gospel of Philip has rather suffered a bad fate, along the lines that Dr. Yonkin said was true of many of these. So we can see here the page which is supposed to have the racy account of Jesus' relationship with Mary Magdalene. Now, the problem comes because the bit that Dan Brown and others have been interested in is actually at the bottom of this page here, which is full of gaps. So let me try and give you a sense of what this manuscript actually says about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, my own translation. And blank, companion of the blank, Mary Magdalene, used to blank, more than the disciples, blank, greet or kiss, the word could mean either, her, blank, times the rest, blank, blank. So reading this is a bit like reading those sort of FBI documents or MI5 documents that have sort of been blank, they have lots of black marker pen used on them in the interests of national security. Now, the situation here is not national security, but rather that worms have sort of got to the text in the sands of Egypt. But this does mean that the sensationalists are really engaging in quite a lot of speculation and being quite presumptuous in claiming that there's evidence of romance here. If there is a suggestion of a special relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene additionally, then it's almost certainly a kind of allegory of how Mary Magdalene, representing the sinful soul, can be reunited with Jesus. There certainly isn't any attempt at providing a historical report of Jesus marrying Mary or anything like that. So unfortunately for the sensationalists, there's nothing really that can give any grounds for us thinking that it says anything about the real Jesus. Additionally, scholars usually date the Gospel of Philip to around the 2nd or 3rd centuries, so quite late, coming from a time 100 or possibly even 200 years after the earthly life of Jesus. So the chances of it having preserved any real new information about Jesus are slim indeed. We know it's actually later than the 4 New Testament Gospels because it quotes from them explicitly by its own admission. So the Gospel of Philip has, "This is why the word says," you know, introducing a quotation. "Already the axe is laid at the root of the trees," from Matthew or Luke. And similarly, "The word says, if you know the truth, this truth will set you free," from John's Gospel. Now, another pretty bad blunder by Dan Brown comes when the character Lee Teabing pronounces sagely that a particular passage in the Aramaic of the Gospel of Philip means something particular. But, of course, the original manuscript of the Gospel of Philip, like a lot of these Gospels, survives only in Coptic. As Dirk said earlier, we don't have the original language of the Gospel of Philip, almost certainly written in Greek, but we only have the Coptic translation. So because it's Coptic as it survives, it can't really provide any grist to the mill of the conspiracy theories which say that the New Testament suppresses the truth, whereas we should really try and uncover the truth about Jesus from these other Gospels. Now, the Da Vinci Code has, of course, had its 15 minutes of fame already, but as I said, the Jesus and Mary Magdalene story has been repeated over and over again, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if it reappears in a few years' time. But it's such a shame when people sort of buy into it, because it's so obviously baseless, in fact. So finally, some comparisons. First of all, I think there are very good reasons to see the portraits of Jesus in the New Testament as those which really anchor Jesus in space and time and in the Jewish culture of his day, in the real culture in which he lived on earth. And as Peter's already mentioned, he goes to places throughout Judea and Galilee all the time. He travels to regions that we know about from contemporaneous literature, from inscriptions, from other evidence. He goes to Jewish festivals all the time. In all four Gospels, he goes to the Passover, and in the Gospel of John, he also goes to the Feast of Dedication and the Feast of Tabernacles, and so on. In the Gospels of Thomas and Judas and Philip, on the other hand, it's striking that we hardly have any single references to Jesus being rooted in actual places. Both of them only have Jesus, both the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Thomas and Philip as well, have Jesus turning up in the world, which is not terribly precise. And the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas refer to Judea. Again, it's a bit more precise than the world, but it's not sort of terribly precise. And the Gospel of Philip also refers to Jerusalem, but that's the only place. Mary is called Mary Magdalene, and Jesus is called the Nazarene, but these don't seem, the places themselves are not mentioned. On the other hand, the New Testament has great long lists of places which Jesus covers in his ministry. This is just a small sampling. Again, you can go through and count the number of words in the Gospels, and while you're doing that, count the number of places. So, as we read the New Testament Gospels, we see a Jesus who's rooted in real space and time, in real Jewish history, and is anchored in this, going from place to place and from festival to festival on his way to his death. So, in the other Gospels, Jesus is separated culturally from Judaism, separated geographically. And in fact, he's also separated from Judaism in another way. In these other Gospels, he's actually quite anti-Jewish, especially in the Gospel of Judas, where the Old Testament creator God is referred to as evil. But also, as we saw as well in the Gospel of Thomas, there's a criticism of the Old Testament as these 24 dead prophets. And this suggests, I think, that these Gospels, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Thomas, come out of an environment which is quite divorced from the Christianity of the apostles, but which has become simply a religion of non-Jews, of Gentiles, cut off from any Jewish framework. On the other hand, the New Testament Gospels are really rooted in Jesus, and as we've seen, insist again and again on Jesus being the fulfillment of the Old Testament. He didn't just appear one day out of a clear blue sky, but his coming was planned by God all along. And when it comes to describing this coming of Jesus, as the New Testament Gospels do, I think they give a much more satisfying account of Jesus' coming. In the New Testament Gospels, we have Jesus coming in the incarnation. That is a sort of technical term for the fact that he really took on a human body. But we don't have that in some of these other Gospels, especially in the Gospel of Judas, where Jesus is not taking on a human body in a real way at all, but rather just being sort of carried around on one. And so in the Gospel of Judas in particular, and perhaps in these others as well, we certainly don't have a Jesus who can identify with us as human beings, and so who can represent us before God. And related to this is that the New Testament Gospels are full of love. Every one of the New Testament Gospels, I'm just catching up here on the slides. Every one of the New Testament Gospels, it didn't take far too long to go through all the references, has God coming to us in salvation in his love. Jesus comes as a result of the loving decision of the Father. And Jesus is the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me, as the Apostle Paul says. Whereas the other Gospels are much more concerned with knowledge, with secret understanding, with the mysterious revelation that one needs to tap into in order to get salvation. But the New Testament Gospels are not elitist books, according to which one needs to find this special knowledge, but rather accounts of God's loving purposes of redemption. Finally, some historical factors. And here we come back to one of the points which Pete Williams made reference to in the first talk this morning. I mentioned at the beginning that the New Testament Gospels are written at a distance roughly between 30 years and 60 years from the earthly life of Jesus, between AD 60 and AD 90. So the last of the New Testament Gospels, the Gospel of John, was probably written at a distance of about 60 years from Jesus. Now, in the grand sweep of history, this is not very long. The other Gospels were, on the other hand, written rather later, probably about 100 years after Jesus, for the earliest ones, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary as well. The Gospel of Mary you can hear about in one of the other DVDs, available still. So the last of the canonical Gospels, John, written about 60 years after, the first of the others written about 100 years after. Now, this is a significant difference. And the reason for that is, while John is writing in around AD 90, there are still people alive who have had contact with the earthly Jesus. But by the time we get to the time when the other Gospels are written, almost everyone, I think probably everyone, has died who had any contact with Jesus. Let me illustrate this a bit more clearly. If the distance in time between Jesus and John's Gospel is about 60 years, then that's roughly the distance that we are from the Second World War. So there are lots of people around, a surprising number of people, who still have adult first-hand knowledge of the Second World War that they can tell us about. On the home front, I can ask my 96-year-old granny about all the officers that she ferried around in her truck, and she tells me which ones were bad-tempered and which ones were good-looking, and so on. Or I can talk to Stan Blake, who is in my prayer group at church, who got engaged in 1940 and fought in Italy and North Africa. All these people, and many others as well, still going strong and can still give us eyewitness testimony of the events in World War II. And similarly, when the New Testament Gospel writers were writing, there's been a continuous tradition. There are still people alive who were eyewitnesses. And many of the Gospel writers draw our attention to this. So Luke 1:1-2, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Or as John's Gospel puts it, the man who saw it has given his testimony, and his testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth, and he testifies so that you may believe. So one assumes that these Gospel writers incorporate material from lots of eyewitnesses, by the other disciples. Luke, perhaps, Luke at the end of Acts, we can see, met lots of figures from the Jerusalem church, and these figures presumably fed in, whether they're major disciples or rather minor characters in the Gospels as well. So as an example of minor characters, Mark's Gospel mentions that Simon of Cyrene, who carried Jesus' cross, was the father of Alexander and Rufus. That man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, why on earth are Alexander and Rufus mentioned here? There's absolutely no reason, so it would seem, for these people to be mentioned. They're not involved at all in carrying the cross. Well, I think the most probable reason why they're mentioned here is that Alexander and Rufus were figures known in the early church, or at least to the congregations that Mark might have envisaged writing to. So they perhaps passed on accounts of how their father carried Jesus' cross. And similarly, Mark also makes reference to the women who watched the crucifixion, and so who are again in a position to pass on to other members of the church what had taken place. It's quite a strong focus there on the fact that they're watching. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph and Salome. But it's not just that these eyewitnesses who are alive during the times when the Gospels were composed in the New Testament, not just that they provide the information, but also while eyewitnesses are alive, they could certainly have a sort of restraining effect on the production of news stories. So it'd be quite difficult when eyewitnesses were still alive, especially in the nearby locality, you couldn't just sort of make up a story about Jesus sort of turning a bit of clay into a sparrow or something. If there were still eyewitnesses around who could say, no, you didn't, I knew him. So these eyewitnesses being alive had a restraining effect on the production of new material. So similarly, if someone from the British National Party comes and knocks on my door and says, you know, Hitler really wasn't that bad after all. National Socialism has sort of had a bit of a bad press. They made the trains run on time. Then I've got a direct historical link to someone who I can ring up my granny, and she can remind me that actually National Socialism wasn't that brilliant after all. So that's why it makes a difference why these other Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Judas, were written after the time of these eyewitnesses. So if they're written from a period about AD 130, AD 140 onwards, they were written when there were no eyewitnesses left alive to provide material for them to use in their Gospels, but they were also alive, they were also writing during a time when there was no restraining influence from these eyewitnesses. And so this perhaps helped from the heretical point of view, helped this sudden proliferation of Gospels that we see in the second century. To continue our analogy of the Second World War, as we've seen, the distance from us to the Second World War is roughly the same as that of John in the writing in the 90s to Jesus. But the situation is very different with the First World War, isn't it? And the First World War is at about the same distance that we are from us as Jesus is from the apocryphal Gospels. So the Gospels of Judas and Philip and Thomas are written at a much greater distance, at about 100-year distance from Jesus, the same distance roughly that we are from the First World War. And of course, you may have read last summer that the last surviving Tommy, Private Harry Patch, died. So we no longer have, at least in Britain, I'm not sure about on the continent, we no longer have any surviving eyewitnesses of the First World War who fought in it. So with the Gospel of Philip and Thomas and Judas, we've entered a new time frame, which is disconnected from the people who knew Jesus firsthand. And you can see on the chart there how we're roughly in the same territory by comparison with the First World War that these new gospel writers are from the earthly life of Jesus. So I hope it's clear from this that there are important differences between the New Testament gospels on the one hand and the other extra-canonical gospels which came later. Not just differences in content, but also real differences in the circumstances under which they were produced, the circumstances which are really strongly cut off from the earthly ministry of Jesus. And so that's reflected both in what they say about Judaism, and we can see that in the distance in time. It's not just that these other Gospels are weird. Of course, if you read the New Testament Gospels, there are some pretty strange things in them as well. But the strangeness that we encounter in the New Testament Gospels is a kind of first century Jewish strangeness. And it's a strangeness accurately reported by these eyewitnesses. Not so that it would fit with our comfortable contemporary expectations, but so that we can see Jesus as he really is. Thanks very much for listening.
Excellent. Thank you, Simon. That was fascinating as well. Well, I think now I'm going to pose a question just for a couple of minutes, quite an involved question, or the topic is quite big anyway, and it's really where the Apocrypha fits in. So the Apocrypha that we have in a book, where does that fit in? When was that written? Should that be part of the Bible that we use in church here? Or maybe you might want to defer whoever would call themselves the resident expert on that. But and what would Jesus have known anything about the Apocrypha? Was it around when he was around? These kind of things.
So on the one hand, we have the Apocryphal New Testament, what one might call the Apocryphal New Testament, which is the usual sort of body of literature, which includes the text that I've just been talking about, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of this, that, and the other that we have. But also there's the Apocryphal Old Testament, which is included in some Bibles, sort of academic study Bibles, or of course some other collections like the Catholic deuterocanonical writings. And these were never really accepted by Jews of the time of Jesus as canonical books. I mean, so that's the first thing. The early Christians basically adopted what was understood at the time to be the Jewish canon. And that's the 39 books that are in our Old Testament. On that, Jews and Christians disagree. But that didn't stop. That, of course, didn't stop Jews writing other books, just like it doesn't stop us writing books that we believe the Bible. And so these other books, like the Book of Tobit, the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon, were composed as, presumably, to assist in piety, to help you understand the Old Testament. So it's fine. It doesn't seem to me that any of them was ever written in an attempt to supplant the Old Testament, and there's no evidence that Jews ever thought that. So, for example, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have lots of commentaries on books like Habakkuk, Isaiah, the Psalms, and lots of the what we would call the Old Testament books. But there are never any commentaries on the Book of Tobit, never any commentaries in the Dead Sea Scrolls on the Wisdom of Solomon, for example. And additionally, many of these apocryphal books were not originally written in Hebrew as well. They were only written in Greek. So none of these were ever accepted by Jews as canonical books. Christians then in the early church, fairly early on, but not at the beginning, Christians then did quote them as sort of helpful, and some even regarded some of them as scripture, as sort of biblical. But they've often had the status in the church of being not inspired, but helpful. So if you read the 39 articles of the Anglican Church of the Church of England, then it draws a distinction between the biblical books, which are divinely inspired and useful for teaching, correcting, and training in righteousness, and so on, but also the apocryphal books, which are not harmful, but useful. Does that sort of begin to answer the question?
So yes.
Pete, do you want to add anything to that?
Anybody want to weigh in? 2 minutes.
Just to be clear that when you go to a Catholic or a Greek Orthodox or a Protestant New Testament, they have all of the same books. So the question we need to distinguish is New Testament apocryphal Gospels, which aren't in anyone's Bibles, but some conspiracy theorists are saying they ought to be considered, and then Apocrypha as an addition to the Old Testament. Now, there, Catholic Bibles, Greek Orthodox Bibles, sometimes have some extra books that aren't in Protestant Old Testaments. Now, the interesting thing there is, of course, I don't like the word Protestant, but sorry, if we can just call it for that and, you know, deal with the politics later, the Protestant Old Testament actually has exactly the same books as you would have if you went down to your local synagogue in their Bible. So in a sense, it's interesting, there's a Christian group and a Jewish group that agree on what books you should have, whereas, in fact, the extra books that you'd find in a Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Bible are a slightly different collection from what you'd have in a Catholic extra collection. I'm going to say a bit more about it if people want to, but for me, it's interesting to have different groups when they agree, if you like.
Good stuff. Okay, well, we can maybe come back to that in the Q&A session. We're going to go for coffee and tray.